The following podcast was created to help 100 Women in Finance members learn more about us, our programs and priorities, and especially our people. In this series, we introduce you to our Global Association board members, the people who steer the organization through sound governance and financial management and ensure that we advance our mission. We hope that you enjoy the podcast, and we welcome your feedback at media@100women.org.
Hello, everyone. I'm Amanda Pullinger, CEO of 100 Women in Finance. On today's installment of our Meet the Board Member podcast, I have the pleasure of speaking with Michelle Morris, one of our newest board members. I'd like to share some background on Michelle. She's an executive director in the Alternative Investments Group of Morgan Stanley Wealth Management, where she leads the Alternative Investments Education Initiative and facilitates business development with financial advisors and their clients across multiple strategies, including hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, private credit, private real estate, and infrastructure. Michelle serves on the board of Bright Point Care in New York City, an integrated healthcare provider for people, families, and communities challenged by health disparities caused by poverty, discrimination, and lack of access to medical services. She's also a member of Operator Collective, a community of tech company operators and founders from diverse backgrounds and investors who are accelerating the next generation of B2B tech. Michelle has an undergraduate degree in economics from the University of Pennsylvania and an MBA from Harvard. Welcome to the podcast, Michelle. Before we begin, I want to acknowledge what for all of us has been a very difficult time. And I'd love to know how you, your family and friends have been holding up. I know you to be an upbeat person, but I imagine the sadness and frustration of the last couple of months has been personally quite difficult.
Amanda, thank you so much for having me today. I'm so excited to be part of this podcast series. And thank you also for pausing to reflect on recent events. The horrific murders of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, Rayshard Brooks, and the killing of so many other people of color, protests against systemic racism, and then the recent loss of our beloved Congressman John Lewis are all events that certainly have made me pause and reflect, as well as my family and friends, and I think the entire global community has paused to reflect. And I think the reaction that I have that I think is shared is that we are all feeling that we're at an inflection point where we have to choose. Are we going to have a global society like based on equality and justice, or are we going to go down another path? And so for me, what I do often is I reflect and get inspiration from poetry. And one of the poems that I go to frequently, which others much more famous than me have used for inspiration, is Invictus. Mm-hmm. Which I think certainly fits the current time more than ever.
Yeah, no, it's a difficult period of time, but I think, as you say, I think in reflecting and in each of us taking responsibility for what we can do to make the world a more just place, I think it's, you know, that's the only way forward, right? That's all we can do.
Absolutely.
Is to play our part.
Yeah, absolutely, and there's so much to be done.
Yes, that's true. All right, well, let's begin with your background. I actually confess to knowing very little about your early life prior to your on-the-record adult life accomplishments. What can you tell us about your life before joining the finance industry, and how did those early experiences lead you toward the work that you do today?
Wow, I'm going back quite a few years, but let me start by saying that, you know, my formative years where I grew up in Boston, where I lived before going to University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and my nuclear family consisted of my parents, who were both professionals. My mom, my mother was a social worker, and my father was a housing lawyer for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts for 30 plus years before retiring. And I also have a younger sister who's had several careers in engineering, teaching, and consulting. And I think growing up for my sister and I, the main focus for us was really our education. And that was something that was ingrained in us from, you know, a very early age, that education was important. And the expectation was that we would excel academically. So there was no question about what our focus was supposed to be as young girls, you know, going through elementary school, middle school, and high school, and on to college. I would say as a young person, you know, we were fortunate to have the opportunity to travel to the Caribbean and Mexico for vacations. I didn't get to Europe, but certainly having exposure to other cultures at an early age, I think did a couple of things. It instilled a travel bug in me, but also as a young person, it gave me an understanding and an appreciation of other cultures and other languages. And so I learned at a young age. I started studying French at the age of 5, and I started studying Spanish when I got to 7th grade. So I really focused on my language skills all the way through high school, and that's something that I think is very important, and I go back and use those skills when I travel today. So that's part of...
It's interesting, Michelle, just to interrupt you, we have done a number of these podcasts with your fellow board members, and it's really interesting that when we talk about early childhood and, you know, formative years, you know, every time it comes back to a family that cares deeply about education and that has given all of us opportunities to travel and experience other cultures. It's so interesting, and for that we have to be very grateful. But there's definitely a theme through these podcasts of backgrounds of people whose parents care deeply about education and care deeply about giving their children opportunities to travel. So it's interesting that you bring those up.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you, and I think it's so important when you have these experiences at a very young age. The other thing I was going to say to you is that before getting into finance, I actually wanted to be a lawyer. I assumed I was going to be a lawyer because my father was a lawyer, and I had no knowledge of Wall Street. My parents were not investment professionals and didn't have any connections to anybody who worked on Wall Street. So the finance industry was actually an enigma to me during high school. I wanted to be a public interest lawyer. I didn't want to be a corporate lawyer. I wanted to really use my skills to help people who did not have the necessary resources to get proper legal representation. I felt that I was privileged, and that I should use my privilege to help others. And that was another theme in my family with regard to giving back and community service, which was really part of my formative education and my narrative growing up. It wasn't until I got to college and decided to change my major from poli-sci to economics that I decided I wasn't going to go to law school and maybe I would try business school.
So tell me a bit about why that shift? What influenced that shift when you were at college?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think as most young people do, you stop and you kind of reflect when you're maybe a junior in college or somewhere in your sophomore, junior year and say, well, gee, what do I really want to do? What am I passionate about? And I kind of thought, well, maybe since I've taken a couple of economics classes, maybe there's something in the business world where I would, you know, where I would fit. And it was just intriguing to me that I didn't really know anything about business. And I just said, before I kind of go down a path of going to law school, let me figure out what some other options are. And I actually had a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, who I did my I took coursework with him and did my independent thesis with him, and he challenged me just about going to law school, because I said, oh, I want to get a joint degree. And he said, well, why do you want to do that? And I said, you know, I didn't really have a good answer. I just kind of always assumed I'd be a lawyer, and I just tacked that on to whatever else I would do. I think, you know, doing the work with that professor in economics and really expanding the way I thought about how I might have an impact in a career going forward, he challenged me to really focus on getting a business school education after college, which is what I then kind of made that shift. I pivoted and decided to major in econ, thinking that that would be a good route for applying to graduate school in the future.
So it's interesting, isn't it, that we spend a lot of time at 100 Women focused on how do we inspire the next generation of young women to think about finance. And very often those pivot points for our members have been a professor, somebody that they meet at university or maybe earlier, who impacts their decision making and kind of opens a whole new world up that you didn't know about. And I think it speaks again to the importance of our work at 100 Women in that area of ensuring that the next generation know what's possible and know all of the options that are out there. So I appreciate you sharing that, because I think it really kind of, you know, reiterates how important our investment as an organization is in terms of the next generation.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more.
So in doing a bit of research about you, we found a really great resource published by the Harvard Business School African American Alumni Association. It was celebrating the 50th anniversary of women being admitted as full-time MBA students at Harvard, and it focused on female African-American MBAs. And the list is a real who's who, and so we found Valerie Grant, who is a senior fund manager, part of our Fund Women initiative at Alliance Bernstein, Kim Liu, Carnegie Corp's chief investment officer, and Patricia Miller-Zola, who's a fund manager at Neuberger Berman, among many other people. And there's also a wonderful write-up about you. And I want to ask you about two things that you noted, which seem apropos to the conversation that we're having now. Speaking about your impact as a Black HBS alumna, you said, "My impact has been to forge career paths throughout many segments of financial services, to serve as a role model for young Black professionals, to be a tireless advocate for diversity and inclusion, and to engage in philanthropic initiatives that promote educational, health, and economic opportunities for minority communities." I want to hear more about this and what it means in a practical sense day to day. You know, most of our members are not Black, but many would like to know how they might be better advocates and allies for minority communities, especially in the context of their finance industry careers. So, tell us a little bit about what you mean by that and what your impact has been.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for asking this question and actually finding that HBS report of my fellow Black HBS alumna. First of all, the folks that you mentioned, Kim and Valerie and Patricia, are all dear friends. And there's so many other wonderful women who are in that report. And another host of wonderful women who have such inspiring stories, who I'm sure will be in the next report that's published. So I just wanted to say that, you know, I felt very thrilled and honored to be included in that group for the first 50-year report. You know, my remarks about, you know, being a tireless advocate for diversity and inclusion is really based on the way I grew up. And so I think there's a saying that goes, to whom much is given, much is expected. And that's certainly a philosophy that was part of my family. We believe that it was our responsibility, with the privilege and opportunity that we had, to promote and be an advocate for people of color and for people who have no voice. And so in my own professional career, what that has meant is that I have been an informal mentor to many, many different people of all races, all ethnicities, all genders, anyone who wants to have the benefit of my experience, I am happy to help them, talk with them, guide them, and make sure that they hopefully learn from some of the mistakes that I've made or from just some of the takeaways that I've had from being in this business for such a long time, being in the finance industry for such a long time. You know, I think that right now you hear a lot about allyship and, you know, how can people be good allies and effective allies? And I'm so inspired by hearing this because I think it's a very good thing. I think it's positive. And I think what allies can do is to speak up and use their voices. And that's really how things change. So it's important for not just people of color to speak up. I'm going to do that anyway. But I think it's important for allies or people who consider themselves or who want to be allies to speak up and use their voices. And how is this done? I think human nature is that we have to start with what's close to us. And so when I think about how someone can be an advocate, I think it starts really in your day-to-day experiences, your day-to-day life, your day-to-day interactions in your community, both inside your professional organization and outside of your professional organization. So, for example, if you are in a professional meeting of importance and you see there's no diversity, well, then maybe after the meeting you can express that view. Maybe we should include some other people in the next meeting to get a diverse set of ideas from other people from diverse backgrounds. You can, as an ally, look around your day-to-day experience, and if your interactions and your peer group is not diverse, then you can be intentional about trying to make your peer group and your social interactions more diverse. Mm-hmm. And these are things that can be done, you know, like one step at a time. So I want to emphasize that sometimes we can get overwhelmed by thinking that this issue that we're dealing with right now, this kind of inflection point about systemic racism and systemic injustice is overwhelming. And sometimes it feels that way. However, I think each individual can, in their own way, do small things, which cumulatively actually do make a difference. So if you have mentees that are not diverse, you can develop, you can reach out and get some diverse mentees. There are just so many things that people can do, and I don't think it has to be overthought. I don't think you have to spend a lot. I think you can just start. I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think a lot of people feel
that's
like
what I would.
Stuck. I think people feel like they're stuck. And so you've actually given those that are listening some really good, easy ways to get started in making a difference. So I really appreciate you giving some specific examples on that. Earlier in your career, you worked in public finance. Essentially, you were an investment banker for public entities, state and local government, helping them to issue municipal bonds to finance important society-serving initiatives like building infrastructure, housing, university dormitories, etc. You know, at 100 Women, we make it a habit to talk about the good that the finance industry does in the world, especially when we're talking to young people who are seeking career opportunities that really, you know, that they really can make a difference in the world. Would you share a bit about this particular phase of your career and how your financial expertise had real world impact?
Wow, this is going back a ways when I first started, but this is I started my career as a municipal banker at Solomon Brothers, which was a tremendous opportunity because Solomon Brothers at the time, and going back to the mid-80s, was the number one firm in municipals. And as a municipal finance banker, what we do is to finance two kinds of bonds, well, more than two kinds, but in particular what's called revenue bonds, so the financing of infrastructure that collects revenue, like bridges and toll roads and water systems and airports, and then what we call general obligation bonds, which the proceeds of which finance general infrastructure projects of cities, counties, and governmental agencies in the U.S. And at the time when I started in municipal finance, there were several black mayors who insisted that firms doing municipal finance, like Solomon Brothers and other major firms, had diverse representation on their banking teams. And so I personally benefited from the advocacy of black mayors and black municipal government officials in terms of allowing me to have an opportunity to be part of the municipal finance industry at a time when there were very few black investment bankers. There was certainly a group that started way before me who paved the way for people like myself to come later on in the mid-80s. So it was a wonderful period in my career, and it was impactful, not just because of the work or the, you know, kind of the work of what municipal finance is, but also because of the importance of the advocacy of black political officials who made it clear that major firms needed to have black representation on their banking teams.
Very interesting. And you know, I think, again, one of the things that, as I mentioned, you know, at 100 Women, you know, we really do want to bring alive to young women the fact that you really can have an impact in the finance industry in many different ways, and in very concrete ways. And so it's very interesting that you have that early experience. And it kind of brings me to, you know, what you're doing now at Morgan Stanley. You're in wealth management and have been for a long time. In your work, you evaluate and select investment firms and private market funds for Morgan Stanley's wealth management platform. You also work with your firm's global sustainable finance group and conduct investment due diligence for your firm's investing with impact platform. So I'm curious, Michelle, what does it mean to be wealthy today in your mind?
Wow, that's a heavy question, Amanda. But I would say that, you know, I think about wealth in a couple of different ways. I think about, so personally, I think many people would agree with me that the concept of wealth and what it means to be wealthy involves more than just the accumulation of financial assets. But for this conversation, let's assume that we're focused on financial assets as kind of the proxy for wealth. And I think wealth is a concept that involves the notion of longevity and passing it on to the next generation. So wealth is distinct from income. Wealth creates a lot of opportunities because of the potential for it to be passed on within families. And so, you know, as individuals and families accumulate wealth, what we're starting to see is a tremendous generational shift in wealth as younger family members make investment decisions. And what's really interesting is that now we're seeing a tremendous growth in ESG investing and in looking at the environment, climate issues, social objectives. And this dramatic growth, I think, is going to continue. I think everyone agrees that this is, you know, it's kind of taking off. It's going to become probably you know, a lens through which all investments will be made eventually. But we see a lot of interest, particularly from younger people and from people who are, you know, when I say younger, I mean millennials and younger, but also from a variety of demographics where there's a interest in making money and returns and also achieving some other social purpose that they think is worthy. And so I think there's a tremendous opportunity for ESG investing right now for people, for it to just take off, you know, in a trajectory that maybe we didn't anticipate even just a year or two ago. And a lot of that, I think, is because of what's happened recently and the focus on social inequity and other issues. So that's an area that I feel very excited about, and I think is directly related to people's concept of wealth and how they want to use their wealth.
Great, thank you. And so finally, you know, I note that you have two young adult children, both of whom now have careers in the finance industry. So you obviously know something about the next generation. So now, speaking as a parent, what guidance and support did you offer to your children that might have helped to shape their career choices? And what guidance would you give to those listening in terms of the advice they may give to their own children?
My goodness, I gave my children, as most parents do, a lot of advice, which I'm not sure they wanted, but I gave it anyway. I think I've always emphasized, my husband and I have always emphasized that both our son and daughter, very, very different personalities and skill sets and interests, but that they should always emphasize their analytical skills, their intellectual curiosity, mm-hmm. and their communication skills, both writing and verbal. And, you know, we taught them a lesson, which, you know, we believe ourselves, is that we are continual learners. You really don't stop your education process. And that as you, you know, think about always being a learner, it means that you're open to learning things, new topics, new ideas, and reassessing the way you may have thought previously. So I think the message for our children, which hopefully, you know, I think they get it now, but we just reinforced those concepts. You know, you're always a continual learner. You have to be intellectually curious always. And you have to be able to, you know, be analytical. You have to be able to communicate. And I think those skills will serve you well throughout your whole life. So, you know, our son gravitated to finance and investing kind of, I want to say, early on. Mm-hmm. And he's pursuing a career in real estate private equity after just graduating from Harvard Business School. And our daughter took a route through capital markets and equity research, and she will soon be joining a venture capital firm focused on fintech investing. So they both ended up as investors, which is terrific.
Very interesting. And we'll have to get your daughter engaged in our recently launched Women in FinTech initiative. So we'll have to get her into the club that is 100 Women in Finance. Well, Michelle, let's stop there. But it's important that we keep this conversation going. So thanks so much for taking the time to talk, and I look forward to seeing you in person at some point. Hopefully for our next board meeting. So thank you so much, Michelle.
Thank you so much, Amanda. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for spending part of your day with us. Remember to follow 100 Women in Finance on our LinkedIn page. You can also enjoy our past programs and connect with other members. in the private section of our website, Community.